Cywar, gaslighting, and Stockholm Syndrome. I don't know if those three phrases mean much to you, but we're going to unpack that tonight. As part of a biblical worldview summit, applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. Today we are facing psychological warfare, gaslighting, and many people have the Stockholm Syndrome. Psychological warfare, or Cywar, involves tactics intended to manipulate one's opponents or one's enemies. This includes the dissemination of propaganda and disinformation to undermine the morale of enemy forces and to erode their ability to resist. Now, I don't know if you know the word disinformation. Misinformation is an honest mistake, typographical error, sincere mistake, no intention to deceive. There's misinformation often, just due to human error. But disinformation is intentional planting of false stories or false bent or shaving off or editing something so that it gives the false impression. There are departments of disinformation in communist countries, and it's part of psychological warfare operations. In the military, terms like Cywar, which means psychological warfare, or PSYOPs, psychological operations, have also been known as winning hearts and minds, or political warfare, or propaganda, or in the South African Army, they called it COMOPs, communications operations. Normally, military intelligence would distinguish between PSYOPs, own forces, which is designed to build up the morale of your own people, and PSYOPs, enemy forces, which could also be called Cywar, which is designed to break down the morale of both enemy soldiers and the enemy civilian population. And then there's PSYOPs local population, or COMOPs local pop, LP, local population. And so, Plaaslike Bevolking, they're called the PBs, winning hearts and minds, and that term. And they would be people sent out with lots of sweets and chocolates and goodies, and maybe they'd be teaching them how to play soccer. I'm sure the Americans are doing no end of things. Do you want some gum? You know, introducing them to basketball and things like that to make them feel better about them bombing their country. PSYOPs recognize that they need to target their audience's belief systems and their value systems and their emotions. Most advertising and propaganda is aimed at people's emotions, not at people's minds, actually. And you'll notice films are more along that line, too, where you have to totally suspend belief. I mean, how can you believe the plots in a Marvel superhero comic? And, you know, it's beyond belief, and they defy gravity and everything, and all logic. But it's aimed at your emotions. It's definitely not aiming at the intellect. And sometimes they aim at the reasoning. We'll get to that later. But they certainly want to affect your behavior. I mentioned last night this picture. But here's it in a paper, a Muslim paper in Britain, a young boy sleeping with his parents, and this is why you must support Islamic values, support the war against the secular government of Assad in Syria, where there's religious freedom for Christians. But it was just a PSYOP. It was a disinformation campaign. It was a fake news, staged picture. His parents weren't dead. He wasn't an orphan. Those weren't graves, and so on. This is just a total psychological warfare. But they got a lot of money with that heart-wrenching picture. Some countries resort to false flag or black ops to discredit the enemy forces by terrorist actions which can be attributed to the enemy. We've got a whole newsletter, Christian Action, on the table back there where we just dealt with the psychological warfare campaigns of false flags and subversion campaigns, which includes, for example, the 1985 bombing of Oklahoma City FBI headquarters, which was an own goal. And it was done deliberately. And not one single member of the FBI or the ATF was in the building at the time that they were apparently targeted. And every eyewitness ended up being murdered, and the local newspaper and TV and radio stations that were exposing it got bought out by groups in New York and Washington, D.C., who then sacked everyone involved in the investigation and got into the cover-up and We've got the videos, got the documentaries. A good friend of mine, General Ben Parton, who was US Air Force scientist who designed everything from cruise missiles to laser-guided weapons, top weapons expert, went to Oklahoma City and said, this was not caused by a truck bomb. This was plainly plastic explosives on these columns. You can't disintegrate reinforced concrete columns from a truck bomb on a road. Doesn't matter how many fertilizer bags are on it. There's no way reinforced concrete can be destroyed into dust by anything other than a contact plastic explosive on the actual columns. And he documented that, and there's a whole lot of others who gave scientific evidence. This was, under the Clinton administration, a false flag. They did a terrorist operation on their own soil to achieve certain political diplomatic goals. And there's a lot of other examples, like the anthrax attacks, which had people hysterical all over America in 2001. And those anthrax attacks were found to be all done by the US government on their own people in order to get people to be stampeded by fear to accept greater powers for the government, less freedoms for themselves, a whole lot of legislation passed by. And there's a lot worse. But anyway, psychological warfare is no longer limited to soldiers. Targets of PSYOPs include civilians, groups, churches, organizations, and governments. And all around the globe now, there's a lot new methods on social media to advance PSYOPs or PSYWAR agenda. Technology and media are increasingly being used to affect political changes designed by the enemy or revolutionary forces. Just think of the 2011 Arab Spring, which was the greatest catastrophe to ever hit the Middle East since the birth of Islam in the 6th century. The destruction of the homes and the bases of millions of Christians throughout the Middle East. Before the war, what they called the Arab Spring, which, by the way, was launched by social media. The first revolution launched by social media. Totally organized by the US State Department under Obama's government. And there were 15 million Christians in the Middle East in 2010. By 2015, it was down to 11 million. I doubt if there's 10 million Christians left in the Middle East. The only parts of the world where the number of Christians and the percentage of Christians has gone down in the last century, Middle East. And that was mostly done by the Arab Spring, which was an anti-Christian revolution funded and sponsored by the US State Department, Hillary Clinton being foremost in front of that. Through fake news and peer pressure, people are taught to self-censor to avoid expressing views that could get them unfriended. So people may know the truth, may have witnessed something that goes against the narrative, but they know if I publish this or if I share this or if I speak up or if I question it, I could lose my job, I could be fired, I could fail to get the promotion, I could fail to get the job, and so on. For example, I was at an Australian pro-life event in Australia, and I took a picture with a contact there, and shortly afterwards he said to me, please don't share that picture. I've realized he's finishing his master's at the university, said, I'll never pass my master's if they see a picture of me at a pro-life event. How about that? Someone doing his postgraduate studies and he's afraid that one picture of him at a pro-life demonstration outside an abortion clinic could terminate his career prospects. And that's not paranoid. That's happened to a lot of people. And so cyberbullying is a reality. And so a vast amount of people have opinions that they keep silent. Now, we know this in the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain, but now we see it in America too, where despite the vast amount of the media telling you, you know, Trump's the worst, everyone loves Biden and Hillary and all that, and yet you still get 75 million people turn out to vote for Trump. Aha, but everyone's meant to hate him. And all of their polls beforehand said there was no chance, and yet a lot of people may not have said openly, but they still voted. Same with Brexit. The people were blindsided when the majority of English voters voted for Brexit. The media was against Brexit. Every political party in Britain was against Brexit. The government, the opposition, a whole lot. And yet the majority of people still voted. I've spoken to people in Britain and in the Netherlands who said, if it was known at work what party I voted for, I would lose my job. And so many people have to keep quiet of what they believe. Praise God if we've still got secret ballots. The Vietnamese commander, Giep, famously declared that the Viet Cong did not win the war on the battlefield. They won on the campuses and in the living rooms in the United States of America through television coverage of American protests against the war. Prime Minister of Rhodesia, Ian Smith, declared, "We were never beaten by enemies, we were betrayed by our friends." President P.W. Botha of South Africa tried to warn the South African population of the total war, which was targeting every aspect of life in South Africa. Now, while the mass media derided this total war, history has proven President P.W. Botha absolutely correct on these points. South Africa was targeted for total war. The Soviet Union and Red China were pumping billions of dollars worth of high-tech weaponry, the best of the best of the Soviet Union, into the whole of Southern Africa, which was one big, inflamed conflict zone. They had their spy ships going around our harbors, and these are pictures taken by the South African Air Force of different Chinese and Soviet espionage vessels around our coasts, or battleships, in this case in Luanda Harbor. Head of the Soviet Navy and Armed Forces of the Warsaw Pact visiting Luanda in Angola. Cuban forces being offloaded off Soviet transports in Luanda Harbor in Angola. Soviet tanks in the streets of Huambo, second biggest city. Communist FAPLA forces being trained by the Cubans in Angola. Fidel Castro coming to see his latest acquisition. In 1980s, Fidel Castro's Cuban troops were in 13 countries in Africa, which were effectively Cuban colonies. And they were taking hundreds of thousands of people from Africa, from Mozambique, Angola, Ethiopia, and so on, to work as slaves in the sugarcane plantations in Cuba to pay for the privilege of having the Cubans scorch earth and loot their countries. The Cubans had 55,000 troops in Angola at one time. 650,000 Cuban troops rotated through Angola during the war there. Soviet missiles in Angola on our border. Soviet MiGs strafing villages in Angola. A picture captured in Angola of two Russian advisors, military advisors. And you can see the Marx brothers, Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Vladimir Lenin, pictures on the wall, and the Vietnamese flag, for goodness sakes. This in Angola, training cadres. Here you can see a South African army took this picture. South African officer, soldier, outside the window doing a raid on Smoke Shell, which is SWAPO headquarters in Angola. And you can see Castro's picture, Brezhnev's. Those are brought from another wall prop there just to give a composite picture. You can see the Soweto and Soviet rank structure, some of their training manuals. Just evidence, oh, that's a Soviet P-76 amphibious armored vehicle. Our men captured multiple rocket launchers. First time anyone had seen anything like this in 1980 in Angola. These are multiple grenade launchers, 400 meter effective range. We document that for Jane's Defense Weekly. South Africa was subjected to total war where the South African Defense Force was spectacularly successful on the battlefield on the border of Southwest Africa, what today is called Namibia. And in preemptive strikes into communist-controlled Angola, some of the biggest battles, both air and land, took place north of Southwest Africa and Angola in the late 1980s. Russian MiGs were shot down. Hind helicopter gunships were shot down. At one hostile press conference in Windhoek, Colonel Dion Ferreira, operational commander of Ops Modular, Hoop and Packer, which three ops that rolled into one another, all cross-border operations countering the Soviet-led Cuban forces' assaults on UNITA and South African forces in Angola. He was challenged to respond to accusations that South Africans had just been beaten in the battles in Angola. So Colonel Ferreira, in typical 3-2 Battalion understatement, said, If defeat for South Africa meant the loss of 31 men, 3 tanks, 5 armoured vehicles and 3 aircraft, then we lost. If victory for FAPLA and the Cubans meant the loss of 4,600 men, 94 tanks, 100 armoured vehicles, 9 aircraft, and other Soviet equipment valued at over R1 billion, then they won. Those are the stats. Those are the facts. And today you can go to Angola as we have, and you can see the wreckage of the high watermark of the Soviet Empire during the Cold War, in the hot part of the Cold War. There are graveyards of Soviet armored vehicles, BRDMs, tanks, every kind of armored personnel carrier. The Soviet tanks can be seen by Google Earth. You can Google Earth Lomba River, and you can see still, and they're not going anywhere, the Soviet tanks roasted on the sides of the road where the South African Air Force or 61 MEK and 155mm howitzers took them out during the high points of the Battle for Lomba River in 1987. The last hot battle of the Cold War. Newsweek, which I call Newspeak, published an article in 1989 that the Cold War was a war in which no one died and no shots were fired. Is it possible that there's a journalist that ignorant as to say no one died in the Cold War? How many millions died in the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Angolan War, the Mozambique War, the Rhodesian Bush War, Southwest Africa? Are you kidding? No one died in the Cold War? Millions died in the Cold War, not counting the tens of millions killed in the Soviet concentration camps in the Soviet Union and in Red China, and the people shot in the back for trying to escape over the Berlin Wall from communist utopia to freedom in the West. They're eyewitness people that we know who've written their stories, like General Keldnes. Our country is being undermined by sabotage, subversion, and sedition. Bombs in this case, a butchery in Ondangra, Namibia. St. James Massacre, which Charles spoke about this morning. I saw these very scenes, including Jared Harker, the 21-year-old man who leapt on the hand grenade in the aisle and absorbed the full impact of a grenade to save the lives of the people around him. On the university campuses and classrooms and the media, on the streets, insidious sedition subvert the public. This is the Magoo bombing on Durban beachfront. Although the ANC could justly be described as the most spectacularly unsuccessful revolutionary movement in the world, which is how the US military analysis of terrorist movements worldwide described them at that time, 1989. With not one single victory to the name in over 30 years of armed struggle, the Allies in the Southern Council of Churches had no problem marching in front of a bloodstained Soviet flag. In the universities, editors of many newspapers, Hollywood, through sports boycotts, disinvestment campaigns, sanctions, general psychological warfare, economic warfare, political warfare waged by the Soviet bloc against first Rhodesia, then South Africa, the European Economic Community, the Organization of African Unity, the British Foreign Office, the US State Department, the United Nations, they all gradually wore down much of our population. To where they, I've got to say they because I was not one of them in agreement, I voted against all this, to where they were willing to settle for a negotiated settlement with a defeated, disgraced, worthless, useless ANC who had not liberated one square inch of territory, had not gained one victory, had not achieved a single thing in 30 years of well-funded revolution. And why did we do it? In exchange for international sports, cricket, rugby, and participation in the Barcelona Olympics coming up in 1992. But we weren't allowed to march under our own flag. We had to march under this flag. Because while Red China, the most dictatorial, oppressive regime in the planet, could have their Communist Party of China flag leading in, while the Soviet Union could have their flag leading in, while Saudi Arabia could, South Africa had to go to the Barcelona Olympics under some Olympic flag. Wasn't allowed to have our own flag in 1992. This was something of a carrot and stick approach. The sticks included economic sanctions, disinvestment, boycotts, bans, riots, sabotage, bombing, sporadic acts of terrorism at home, increasing condemnation from abroad. The carrots were opportunities to participate in international rugby tours to New Zealand and Australia, cricket tours to England, and the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. Isn't it worthwhile selling your future, your country, your children, grandchildren's future for a ball game? What a deal. In PSYOPs, propagandists target adversaries by seeking to destroy, by psychological means, the morale and confidence of their targeted opponent, to the extent where they begin to doubt the validity of their beliefs, their values, and their actions. Now you see, just like the Viet Cong couldn't beat the American army on the ground in Vietnam, but they beat them back at home through protests and through TV coverage, so the South African army could never be beaten on the ground. But they managed to reach some of our population and some of our leaders, including traitors like Rolf Meyer, who's meant to be our Minister of Defence, chief negotiator with ANC, who says he's fully supporting of expropriation of compensation, supports Ramaphosa, now votes for the ANC, has joined them. And people like that told us we were getting a good deal to give it all away in exchange for some sports games. So this ex-KGB defector, Yuri Bezmenov, testified in 1984 how Marxist revolutionaries identify four stages of ideological subversion: demoralization, destabilization, crisis, followed by normalization. The highest art of warfare, he said, is not to fight at all, but to subvert everything of value in the country of the enemy, until such time that the perception of reality of the enemy is screwed up to such an extent he does not perceive you as an enemy. You can then take your enemy without a single shot being fired. And this is what is happening all over the world. Communists are not good at winning battles, not military battles. But boy, can they win negotiations at tables, because they have no intention of keeping to their side of the bargain. They can lie. Boy, can they lie. And they can demoralize. And so here's the demoralization, which I say takes about a generation. Religion. Politicize, commercialize, entertainment, get it to a death wish. Education. Promote permissiveness, relativity, goal, ignorance. Media. Monopolize, manipulate, discredit, focus on non-issues. Result. Uninformed myopia. Culture. False heroes and role models. Think Marvel comic superheroes. Addictive fans and the masses. After taking ideas, you want to take the structure, law and order. Get it all on legislation, not moral. Imagine if our police exerted half the energy on fighting real crime like violence and theft that they exert to enforce mask wearing and to keep people off beaches and walking their dogs or something like that. And you say they've moved from dealing with moral issues to dealing with legislation. Enforce the mask, the curfew, which has nothing to do with the moral issue. But you see, that's the point. You move policing and law and order from moral to legislative. Social relations, you go from your obligations to rather your rights. That's less individual response. Security, leave the people defenseless. Internal politics, foster disunity and antagonism. Foreign, well, basically isolate yourself from your friends. These things aren't accidents. You know, if you make a mistake, we're all human, make mistakes. If you make the same mistake twice, you're stupid. You make the same mistake 5, 10, 20, 50 times, you've got a hidden agenda. No government can be that stupid, that they always do the wrong thing. And to explain that, well, you know, but it's a plan. And here we've got Yuri Bezmenov, former KGB agent, defector, telling us this is how they work. And what is their goal? Deland the people, urbanize the people, alienate the people, and get them victims and make them vulnerable and dependable on the government. Destabilization. Doesn't matter what the issue is, make an issue, get the people angry. Create a crisis every now and then. And then normalize, just temporarily, for another crisis later. Unprecedented mass communications media opportunities to manipulate emotions can be seen in how modern mass media communication techniques have allowed unprecedented opportunities for foreign forces to engage in direct communication with a targeted enemy population. If you want to research it, you will be staggered at how much of the US mass media that you and I are exposed to are owned by the Chinese Communist Party. The vast majority of Hollywood studios are owned by the Chinese Communist Party to such a controlling extent that you will not see them ever produce anything that puts China in a bad light. The Chinese Communist Party has a death grip on a vast amount of media worldwide, and in this country, enormously, and in Zimbabwe, colossal. Why do they want farm invasions in South Africa? I can tell you in a very short order. To strip mine them for minerals that China's looking for. And you say, but then people die of starvation. Well, China doesn't care. They've got enough people anyway. And the goal is not the population, it's the raw materials. China was able to strip mine a whole lot of farms in Zimbabwe once they took it away from the 5,000 commercial farmers. Okay, the people in Zimbabwe have starved ever since and half the population's fled, but they managed to find the Mereng diamond fields in what used to be farmlands in southeastern Zimbabwe and fourth largest diamond fields in the world. Totally. The Chinese government has got an airport at Mereng, the biggest aircraft in the world, the Antonov 126s. Land there and fly direct back to China with the diamonds. They don't go through Ori, they don't go through customs. The government in Zimbabwe has not had any income from the diamond mines entering the public coffers at all. Of course, the leaders in the government must get something, but the people are still some of the most taxed people on the planet.
When did that happen?
Mereng diamond fields, I think, were discovered about 2008. China got control over Zimbabwe quite early. Remember, Robert Mugabe was trained in China, and China was the primary support. In fact, Robert Mugabe made Chinese a compulsory subject in the University of Harare. I don't know any country in the world, even in China, where Chinese is a compulsory subject, but in Zimbabwe, it's a compulsory subject, or at least was for many years. I don't know if it still is at this moment. And at one stage, because of protests against Chinese being a compulsory subject, Mugabe closed the University of Zimbabwe down for a whole year. Just, can you imagine that you can just close the university? Well, yes, now we can imagine because it's happened to us too. But you see the principle. Distract, deceive, divide. Identity politics, race politics, gender politics. It doesn't matter what the issue is. They never care about the issue that they're claiming to be, because in every single case, the people they claim to be advocating for, whether it's the proletariat, the poor, the workers, the women, the minorities, whatever they are, they all end up worse off afterwards than they did before. So it's, all these politics are just designed to deceive, to distract, and to divide. In recent times, the internet allows for campaigns of disinformation and misinformation, including false flags and agent provocateurs to seek to discredit or character assassinate those they like to target. So, for example, especially in free societies, you don't have a security clearance background check for the average church, college, organization. How easy is it for Marxists or other insidious groups to infiltrate good groups doing good things, to say something outrageous, to post something unacceptable, to create a problem, and then the whole group gets blamed. And that person disappears. And next thing you're all there holding the bag for what they did, and they did it to specifically discredit you, and this is done all the time. Character assassination of people whom they target. They can conjure up almost anything on anyone. Back in 1994, which is in the first year of the new elections in South Africa, Reverend Kenneth Meshu invited me to his office in Parliament, and he said, Peter, what I've just seen is absolutely shocking. He said, I'm on the Portfolio Committee for Intelligence. He says, we have the ability to eavesdrop on everything. Now, this is 1994. We're not talking about now. When our capability is so much more. He said, photographic evidence is now almost meaningless because they could produce photographs that look, and videos that look like it's you. He said, they could produce a video making it look like I'm involved in a pornographic activity or perverted activity, and you couldn't even tell it from the real thing. Now, it was 1994, 26 years ago. Kenneth Mesher said, Peter, they can character assassinate any of us. They can manufacture audio, video, or still photography, manufactured fake evidence in order to character assassinate whoever they want. And he was afraid. The Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism recognized that while World War I and the military defeat of the Tsarist Russia provided a unique opportunity for the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, violent revolution was unlikely to succeed anywhere in Western Europe. Lenin got lucky. Therefore, Marxist leaders like Antonio Gramsci proposed the termite strategy to erode from the inside the cultural institutions of the West. Just as a termite could hollow out the inside of a wooden building so that even fresh coats of paint on the outside wouldn't save the structure from collapsing in time, so too Marxists need to work for slow, gradual, long-term, culminative revolution through infiltrating the five cultural carrying culture-transforming institutions of Western society. And to do this, he spoke about critical theory, critical race theory, and the Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism. The five institutions are educational institutions. Anyone recognize this person? Blade Nzimani. Do you know what his position was at the moment this picture was taken? He was the Minister of Higher Education in South Africa. Do you know what his political affiliation was? You'll never guess. He was the General Secretary of the Southern Communist Party. Do you think the communists have managed to infiltrate education institutions in South Africa? News media is number two. Manufacturing dissent. By the way, just for fun, they used to advertise things like this. Nicotine cigarettes, a smooth taste expectant mothers crave. No flies in me, thanks to DDT. Let the magic mineral asbestos protect the buildings of your farm. And heroin hydrochloride, 2 to 3 to be taken by order of physician daily, compressed tablets. Notice fire. How to manufacture consent, how to manufacture the political economy of the mass media. During World War I, Edward Bernice pioneered commercial propaganda, which he abbreviated to PR. Now, PR is the first two letters of propaganda. But later they came out, because he meant commercial propaganda. Later they termed it public relations, which sounds better than propaganda. He became known as the father of spin. Now you notice the pictures here. The one thing is of a woman smoking. Edward Bernice, after World War I was over, he's out of a job, propagandist for the US government. So he went to Lucky Strike and he said, I can double your sales. And they said, how on earth is that possible? Every man in America smoking. He said, I can get the woman smoking too. And I said, that's impossible. Nobody will get women to smoke. He said, give me the budget. I'll get American women to smoke. And he succeeded. And he called them torches of freedom and had models posing with cigarettes. And he said, how do you like this for subtle? Light a lucky and you'll never miss the sweets that made you fat. How's that for subtle? And all sorts of promoting, like, women don't need to wear those kind of bathing costumes anymore, and now they can smoke too. An ancient prejudice has been removed. Forget about your lungs and your health. And lies, lies, and more lies. And by the way, if you want your love to last longer, smoke cigarettes together. I suppose you'll die earlier together, whatever. But anyway, whatever it is, apparently that kind of, better than a wedding ring. Have smoke rings. And so this is the cover of his book, Propaganda. The target is a woman smoking. Target. Edward Bernays is the father of PR, the father of spin, propaganda. So we've got fake people, fake food, fake medicine, fake weather, fake news, fake history, fake pandemics, fake revolutions, and fake spirituality. And you wonder why people hate the truth. Whenever there's a big story in the media, look for the story they're trying to distract you from. First is education, second is news media, third is entertainment industry. The Bible says, I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. There must be nothing more wicked than what comes out of Hollywood and through the mainstream entertainment industry. Fourth, culture-carrying institution, religious institutions. And if they infiltrate them. And of course, fifthly, political institutions. His slogan was, capture the culture. Now, Herbert Marcuse was also part of the Frankfurt School of Marxism, and he emphasized the importance of subverting the culture through obscenity, blasphemy, perversion, and propaganda. And he says, we need to use swear words as verbal grenades to attack bourgeois Christian society. Make swearing, blasphemy, and obscenity and crudity part of the arts, part of the theater, part of the stage, subvert culture. Obscenity and blasphemy are weapons, he said, in the psychological war to break down civilization, Christian civilization. And hence you find blasphemy and antichrist prejudice is mainstreaming in many parts of the world today. Pastors and evangelists have been arrested and prosecuted for preaching what the Word of God teaches in Romans 1 concerning just perversion, for example. Herbert Marcuse advocated in his 1965 paper, Repressive Tolerance, he said we need to set up a victim coalition of people who could be convinced that they're oppressed. This cadre of people would become the new proletariat to establish the long march through the institutions of the West. These new oppressed would be brainwashed into thinking that their oppressors were biblical Christians. This strategy included casting Christians as narrow-minded bigots who were by nature racist, xenophobes, homophobes, Islamophobes, misogynists, and greedy capitalists. All of this would be definitional of what it means to have white privilege. By the way, I don't know how many people have noticed, but 70% of Black Lives Matter are white. In any march, organization, they even started, Black Lives Matter is a white-started, white-run organization. They're just using these people. This new proletariat has taught the wonders of tolerance for everyone except Christians, against whom intolerance must be practiced at every turn. In his 1965 paper, Herbert Marcuse gave justification for this new intolerance. Liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and tolerance towards movements from the left. As to the scope of this tolerance and intolerance, it would extend to the stage of action as well as discussion and propaganda of word and deed. Tolerance is a device used to introduce a new law system as a prelude to a new intolerance. When I grew up, liberals were advocating for no censorship, for free speech, for freedom of opinion. Now, liberals are advocating ban hate speech, ban this, that's not acceptable, you can't say that, that's politically incorrect, this can't be allowed, and so on. Of all the tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may probably be the most oppressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep, but those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. And that is why Karl Marx said the first battlefield is rewriting of history. It's definitely one of his books. I'll try and find it for you.
And second, sorry, just the final institutions that were mentioned to change culture.
Yes.
That was specifically for the West. Is it different for me?
No, but I think they recognized in the West that was the goal of the Frankfurt School, trying to, they said, we can't replicate the Bolshevik Revolution, but we've got to work from the inside because the West is too Christian. And so what Gramsci said is we need to get the Christians in the West to no longer think with regard to the Bible or God, but to think without reference to God or the Bible or Christ in particular to every area. And in that sense, I think you've got to say the Bill Crosby Show is a classic example of the Marcusean strategy, cultural Marxism strategy, because they had this good, ideal, happy family where they never mentioned God and there's no Bible. Just like one of my children asked me once, why does Barney never mention Jesus? I said, because Barney is a humanist. And that's the point. You've got a whole lot of where they've got moralizing nonsense in the mainstream media, but it's not Christian. And they're trying to suggest you can be good without God. And that's part of the cultural Marxism as well. George Orwell observed, the most effective way to destroy a people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. So those who understand Marxism, particularly the cultural Marxism of the Frankfurt School, the Gramsci strategy and the role of obscenity in Marcuse's revolutionary strategy, will immediately recognize where the violence and the campaign to topple statues and monuments and spray paint obscenities on walls comes from. By the way, when Bill Clinton became president of America, he was asked, 1993, by Newsweek, who's been the most influence in his life? And he said, Antonio Gramsci. When Hillary Clinton was aiming for the presidency, she was asked who had been the most influential thinker in her life, and she said, Herbert Marcuse. Both of them cultural Marxists of the Frankfurt School. Straight out of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution and the public humiliation, shaming, apology scenes is exactly how Mao Zedong publicly shamed and sidelined and humiliated the traditional leaders in China's revolution. The Chinese Communist Party would have public humiliation ceremonies for religious and cultural leaders to degrade and to disgrace the previous respected leaders, whether they were Confucian, Buddhist, whether they were school teachers, mayors, town councils, whatever it was. They shamed them, they beat them, they humiliated them, they tortured them, and then finally they executed them. George Orwell warned us in his prophetic 1984 novel of Newspeak, thought police and thought crimes. Looks like you've had a little bit too much to think. Closed minds stop thought crimes. Opponents would be vaporized, made unpeople, would disappear down the memory hole. Those are terms from 1984. Aldous Huxley warned us in his prophetic book, Brave New World, written in the 1930s, of a future sophisticated society where people would be distracted by endless entertainment stimulation and subdued by drugs to make them easily manipulated by the New World Order state. So George Orwell, omnipotent state surveillance, and Aldous Huxley's view of the Brave New World, whereby drugs and endless stimulation distraction, is coming true, both of them, today. John Dewey, one of the authors of the Humanist Manifesto of 1933, was a pioneer of secular state education. And we should be able to recognize that much of the entertainment industry is defiling and degrading us. Much of the news media is discouraging us and distracting us from real issues. And the garbage on Slime Magazine and Newspeak and Useless News and World Report defies belief. The first casualty of war is truth. So much of this society today, including music and arts, depresses and disgraces us. And it's designed that way. It wasn't inevitable. It's not the way it has to go. In fact, if you study history, periods of permissiveness in society is often followed by a real sort of Victorian putting the brakes on and people lifting up traditional values and so on. So things don't have to necessarily automatically go in a downward decline. In fact, there's short bursts of it, and these outbreaks of immorality normally are crushed under their own weight. They normally die out. And the ones who come out of the disaster put in place much stricter controls to prevent that happening in the future again. Okay, getting to the end. What about gaslighting? How many people have heard the term gaslighting before and understand what it means? A few people. Okay. Gaslighting comes from a famous film which Ingrid Bergman really, it was one of her award-winning entries which made her a world-famous star. Ingrid Bergman was being gaslighted. Now, the gaslighting back in 1800s in England, where the story is set, your lights came from gas. And so if you put on other gas lights, the lights in one room were dim while the other ones came up. It had just got the same source of flow. And so kept seeing every night about the same time, a few minutes after her husband had left for his evening walk, the lights would go down. And she has been told, you're imagining things. As it so happens, her husband was a criminal who had murdered her aunt and who was wanting to get her back, where she had fled away from the scene of the horror, back to the house, which had been closed up, because some of the jewelry that he was trying to steal and was surprised was there. And so in order to complete his crime, he was gaslighting his wife. He was convincing her that she was going mad and that she was losing her memory. And he'd regularly steal things and then blame her for having misplaced them. He would be emotionally abusing her. So the term gaslighting entered the dictionary as a result of this film by Ingrid Bergman in the 1930s. Very powerful, effective. And unfortunately, we see this tactic where abusive people blame the very people they're victimizing to blame themselves for the abuse. You also hear of codependency, where people make excuses for an abusive husband, like, no, I fell down the stairs, I walked into a pillar, I bruised myself, and they make up lies to defend their abuser because they believe they're the ones to blame. Gaslighting is one of the words. Guilt manipulation is another term. Vilifying the victims, victimizing the villains. Victim blaming, you know, why was she walking alone at that time of night? Well, how's the victim to blame? How about blaming the criminal? And this is the way it's often. Oh, you know, that farmer shouldn't have been out in the field at that time of night or whatever. And somehow the victim is to blame. Guilt tripping. The manipulator suggests that the victim doesn't care enough, is too selfish, has had it easy, and make the victim continually feel bad, keep them in a self-doubting, anxious, submissive position. So this politics of guilt and pity aims to undermine Christianity and nationalism in particular to support international socialism, communism. Now, the Stockholm Syndrome is another term where many are cowed into codependency with their very abusers. They found this, that people are kidnapped, such as in Stockholm at that famous bank hijacking robbery, where the victims who were covered with explosives and were being used as human shields literally went out of the way to defend their abusers who were threatening to kill them, because they transferred all their hope onto the one who had their life in their hands, and they projected on them the best of intentions and assumed the police outside were the real enemies than the ones who were a very weird psychological factor. It's been, how many books have been written on it, the Stockholm Syndrome. Cultural Marxism has deteriorated society. Critical race theory has divided society. Confuse, divide, and conquer. You know that you live in a brainwashed society when white people are protesting against white people for being white people and for being racist. Well, how racist is that? Most of Hollywood entertainment degrades and degenerates us. The Gramsci termite strategy has corrupted and rotted most of the institutions in the West. The Mercusian subvert and corrupt of the culture campaign has been all too successful. Not only is perversion now tolerated, it's promoted and celebrated, even in some churches. Degenerate entertainment, defiled art, decadent culture are part of the strategy of cultural Marxists to rot the soul of a nation. We're seeing communism in the classroom and a worn out historic monuments on the streets. Discouragement, distraction, depression, dependency, deterioration, division, degeneration, degradation, disintegration, all equal defeat. A whole litany of disastrous D's. So we need to understand our times. We need to know what God's people should do. History matters. Truth matters. We need to get back to the Bible. We need discernment. We need to disconnect from the world, indoctrination, distraction, and disinformation media. We need to support alternative, independent sources of news media. Support independent and alternative source of entertainment. And exercise discernment and discretion as to what we watch. We need to get back to the great Christian books that build up civilization, and we need to boycott the modern trash that's breaking it down. Home education using solid, Bible-based, Christ-centered, God-honoring, CAT-approved textbooks will be the single most strategic, important foundation that can be laid for reclaiming a culture for Christ. This is the most countercultural, politically incorrect, revolutionary thing you can do today. Be straight. Marry. Have children. Raise them in the fear of the Lord. On a Christian curriculum, how countercultural can you be than that? That is what the New World Order must hate with a vengeance, and they do. Some of the antidote to the psyops, gaslighting, guilt manipulation, Stockholm syndrome, cultural Marxism, indoctrination are the examples of excellence that we can learn from Christian history. Which is why I've written books like Victorious Christians Who Changed the World, 32 chapters that came from 32 presentations at our Reformation Society, going from Perpetua to Mary Slessor, 32 great Christian characters through history. The Greatest Century Reformation, 16 biographies on the 16 greatest reformers of the 16th century. The Greatest Century Missions, 19 biographies on 19 greatest missionaries of the 19th century. Sketches from South African History, which is also available in Afrikaans. An Afrikaans edition is much better. It's got extra chapters from Koen Elgin and Stephen Mitford Goodson. Because history is a battlefield. We need to know our history. We need to get back to the Bible, every book of the Bible. And we set up our Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism website and Facebook page to give alternative sources of media. And there's a lot of good things put on there. Visit movieguide.org by Ted Baer to evaluate films. It's important to know before you go, to learn to discern, to clean the screen, to boycott the bad and to support the good, the uplifting and the excellent. Dr. David Noble's Understanding of the Times is the single best textbook explaining the different competing worldviews and a biblical response. And this has also been summarized by a more compact book, The Battle for Truth. Answers in Genesis, The Creation Museum, The Ark Encounter are absolutely foundational, phenomenal resources, strategic antidotes to the new secular humanist evolutionary attacks, the cultural revolution that we're facing today. Evangelistic tools to win our world, including From Living Waters, Way of the Master, Ten Commandments-based evangelism, which you'll learn more about tomorrow morning. Because the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. Our Great Commission course, which we'll next have at the middle of this year, June, July, is part of our strategy of training Christians in intensive body, mind, and spirit three-week program who are interested in changing our world. Why should we just be reactionaries reacting to the enemy? Let's be Great Commission Christians who are setting the agenda, putting feet to our faith. That's why you're at the Biblical Worldview Summit. This is a first step to reclaiming our culture and biblical principles for Africa. So, any questions, any comments? Education, entertainment, news media, religious institutions, political institutions. Those are the five. Alistair?
Two questions. So one is just regarding the analytics of the issue that was before. I'm curious what the largest pressure points are. I mean, again, I was in the mind. So what were the sanctions that hurt? I mean, were we running out of fuel or what?
No. In fact, okay, sanctions. The question is, did sanctions really hurt us? Well, as it so happened, sanctions only helped Rhodesia and South Africa. Because we started to produce all the things that we used to import. And we produced better, actually, to the extent that our enemies started to buy from us. No arms for South Africa. Well, after a while, America is buying our G5 howitzers, and Rhodesia's barter tackies were so good they were being exported, and we found we could import so many, we could produce so many things better than importing. And it improved our economy and brought more jobs. And there was a boom in the economy of South Africa and in Rhodesia with sanctions. Sanctions economically didn't really hurt. But cultural sanctions and the inability to take part in the Olympics or the Paraplegics Olympics, rugby, cricket, that hurt. And I would say those hurt us far more. Well, not me personally, but it's hurt far more the country as a whole than the economic sanctions. We are such a phenomenally rich country in terms of minerals and everything else, and agriculturally, we're so self-sufficient, they couldn't have defeated us by economic sanctions. And they didn't defeat us militarily, they didn't defeat us economically, despite all the sabotage and everything. In the end, they just talked everyone into giving up. They didn't call it that. Negotiated settlement. Rainbow country. And as Nelson Mandela promised, never, 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 never again will any South Africa ever be discriminated on the basis of his race. Isn't it wonderful? That there's no, you know, those 120-odd race quota, BBBEE laws, they apparently don't exist.
There was a second question.
Yes.
It's interesting. Communist strategy seems to have quite a lot of division, or say, take a case over, you know, 50, yeah, I would say 30 to 50 a time, like, countries like the States, for instance. But I don't see the motive that would sort of govern the long term. I don't understand why a leadership that doesn't want to uplift these people would. You are there trying to, you know, if I have to wait 50 years before accomplishing a goal, I'm dead and gone, and
isn't that inspiring? Why is it that communists are willing to work the whole lifetime for a goal they may not see in their lifetime, but for the greater goal? It's amazing. In many ways, communists can be a better example of having a world vision and having a missionary vision to want to win the world, of course, to an evil system, but you've got to admire the dedication to the cause.
Don't understand the motive.
Book describes it as fire in the minds of men. And Richard von Brandt and also Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the primary motive of communism is hatred towards God. Malice, malevolence, hatred towards God is the essential pivot and is the energy that drives its whole course forward. And said its economic pretensions and political aspirations are just side issues. The heart and soul of what makes Marxism work is hatred to God. Personally, I think it's insanity. I think it's demonic. I think it's driven from the pits of hell. You can see it from the fruit. And if you study Karl Marx himself and see what a antichrist, Marxist, Satanist Karl Marx was, literally, you understand what motivates communism. But most people in communism who are working for it are probably working for it because they believe in an idealistic ideal. A freer world, a more just world, an equitable world, a world of equality, where from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And the way some people put it in propaganda, it sounds good. Of course, it's never worked that way in practice. It's like the PR propaganda is up here. The reality is way down there. If they would study history, it's like, okay, if you were to say, look, slavery was just badly implemented, but if we implement slavery the right way, it would work. And yet, they do this with communism and socialism. Okay, it's failed everywhere, but we're going to do it different next time. So it's not logical. It can't stand historical scrutiny. But I think there's a lot of idealism in communism, and there are the idealists out there, sincere idealists. And then there's the malevolent, malicious, satanic, demonic people who are just driven by that. And you'll get both in the movement and probably a whole lot in between. Some people are just caught up in it. Maybe some are pressured into it by family, economics. Some might not have known anything else. Some are just brainwashed. But many communists come to Christ and become its most significant opponents.